Hi, everybody. Matt Polka here with the American Cable Association, back with another exciting episode of Cable Talk, our Cable Talk podcast at ACA. We are so pleased today to have Craig Moffitt with us, who is the founding partner of Moffitt Nathanson. Craig is the number one analyst in our industry, just about ranked by everybody, whether it's Institutional Investor Magazine, whether it is Bloomberg, whether it is Greenwich Research's annual market survey. Craig has been covering our industry for so many years. Prior to that, at his time at Moffitt Nathanson and at Sanford Bernstein and Company, Craig was also in the auction business, where he was president and founder of the e-commerce business at Sotheby's Holding, the venerable auction house, and before that had spent 11 years at the Boston Consulting Group, where he was the leader of BCG's global telecommunications practice from 1996 to 1999. Craig, welcome, and welcome to our latest edition of Cable Talk.
Thank you for having me, Matt. Pleasure to be here.
Well, Craig, as I mentioned in my brief intro, you have covered our industry for quite some time. Tell us a little bit about that and maybe what has drawn you to cover this industry at such depth for such a long time.
Well, you know, it's funny. I started in the telecom business back well before the 1996 Telecom Act. And I remember in my consulting days, in those days, my clients were primarily the telephone companies. I remember coming out of the 96 Act and thinking, well, look, this is not that hard to figure out. The irrespective of the deep pockets and the powerful brand names of the telephone companies, cable infrastructure has vastly more capacity than the telephone infrastructure. And ultimately, this is a game that the cable companies are going to win and the telephone companies are going to lose. And when I came to Wall Street, I remember thinking, I've got to get that message out quickly because it's not going to take people very long to figure it out. I got to Wall Street in 2002. And I remember thinking, by 2003 or 2004, people will understand how this story is going to end. It ended up taking about another 10 years, before people, I think, finally figured out that cable's infrastructure was going to be the winning infrastructure. It probably wasn't until 5, 6, 7 years ago, maybe, that was understood by the capital markets. But that was, for me, maybe the most interesting part of the discussion is I've made it a career now for about 20 years in a very, very simple proposition, which is cable companies aren't media companies. Cable companies are infrastructure providers, and they've got the winning infrastructure. And it's amazing that you could build a 20-year career out of a sentence that short, but that's kind of it.
Well, that's fascinating, particularly as you refer to our industry as infrastructure, because there is so much talk in Washington, of course, where we work, about infrastructure, broadband deployment, what the government can do to encourage greater deployment. And I think you're right about that. So what was it specifically, though, that really was the turning point? You had covered actually the telecom industry beforehand when you were at BCG. But at some point, when you saw that turning point about the difference between maybe the traditional telecom companies, and you saw cable's future, what was it that really was that trigger to say, this is really something interesting that I want to cover?
Well, it's funny. In my days at BCG, I used to describe myself not so much as a specialist in telecom, but as a specialist in high fixed cost, low variable cost businesses, because I always thought that the problem of strategy in businesses that had essentially no or very limited variable cost was fascinating. And, you know, if you think back to the lessons you learn in Economics 101, they're all about when price equals marginal cost and things like that. And when marginal cost is zero, you're sort of flying without a compass. And so I just always found those strategy questions really interesting, and that was probably what drew me into the industry and made me decide I wanted to spend a career trying to sort some of this stuff out.
Well, I have a question at the end of our talk today, looking into your crystal ball, but as you look back, covering our industry over the last 20 years, what would you say might be the biggest surprise you weren't expecting, or perhaps, you know, the biggest development that has had the most influence on our industry?
Well, the biggest development, you know, it's funny. It's funny how much attention people lavish on OTT video, and every generation of whether it's investors or operators sort of seems to think that that the concept of OTT video is theirs and theirs alone, and they're the generation that has saw it first and figured it out. We used to talk about it inside of BCG as early as the late 1990s. In fact, even before the internet was named the internet, before the creation of the World Wide Web and the Mosaic browser, we used to talk about the day that that video would be delivered over public networks. I wrote a piece of research when I got to Wall Street, a few years after I got to Wall Street, that you will probably remember, called the Dumb Pipe Paradox, in 2006, that made the argument that, look, if what you're worried about is becoming a dumb pipe, find something else to worry about. Broadband is a better business than video, and if you lost the entire video business, your revenues would go down, but your costs, your direct costs of programming would obviously disappear with it. A lot of your indirect costs of customer service and repair and maintenance would also go down. And so your EBITDA would only go down by a little bit. Your capital intensity would go down by quite a bit. And so your free cash flow would actually rise. Your return on invested capital would be higher. And you would actually have a much better business. And what's most interesting about that proposition isn't the logic of it, because I think now that logic is reasonably well understood by most people in the industry. It's that was a debate 12 years ago.
Sure.
And that we're still having that same debate of, you know, where does video take us, and is video still critical, and blah, 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 blah. It's astonishing. You know, when I first got to Wall Street, I remember when cable stocks got crushed when iTunes decided to put Desperate Housewives on iTunes, and mm-hmm. And everybody thought, well, here comes the end of the media ecosystem, and you know, people have been having this debate for a really long time, and it's just not that novel anymore.
Fascinating discussion, particularly recalling your research on the quote unquote dumb pipe. So let's talk about that as we begin to talk a bit more regarding our members and cable operators and broadband providers' future, OTT, and maybe some competitive issues out there as well from new entrants. But while we're still on the dumb pipe analogy, so to speak, and given the nature of the debate, which is going on within our industry and our membership as well, I mean, is it ultimately inevitable that cable operators will go to an all-broadband platform, meaning that they will eliminate those two big cost centers of programming and set-top boxes?
I think they will. There's a lot of different ways to get at that. You've already seen small operators either entirely or largely move away from the video model. You know, I remember Stephen Weed and the guys at Wave were some of the first to do it. Cable One does it today, but there's a lot of smaller operators that have sort of been at the vanguard in your membership of saying, it's just, I don't make money at this anymore, and it's no longer a compelling proposition for me. Particularly, you know, it's funny, the argument for set-top boxes for a long time was not, I want to control the customer's user interface and branding, or that I make so much money off the set-top boxes that I want to keep them in the system. It was more that I want to make sure that I have full control of the user experience to ensure that if a customer calls in with a complaint, I've got the visibility into the delivery chain in order to make sure that I can fix it. And I think that argument has worn a little thin. And people now recognize, look, customers hate set-top boxes, and why do we keep forcing them to take them? Mm-hmm. If a customer wants to have an Apple TV or a Roku, great. And so I think that the first interim step will be that cable operators that want to continue to be in the aggregation function for video will start to do it more and more through an IP version that runs as an app on someone else's set-top box that runs on either a Roku box or an Apple TV box or an Amazon Fire Stick or what have you. And that later they will wean themselves even from that and say, why in the world do I want to continue to negotiate contracts with Disney and ESPN? Let the customer negotiate a contract with Disney and ESPN. I'll happily help the customer choose their ideal video package, whether it's from YouTube TV or Hulu or whoever it is, and maybe I'll even get a sales commission for that. But mostly what I'm doing is saying I no longer want to be in the business of repair and maintenance and customer service for set-top boxes that ultimately customers don't like anyway.
It's so true, particularly when I look back at my own career, not only from a business perspective with independent cable operators, but even in Washington. I mean, so many of our issues have focused on control of content, access to content, availability of content really through only one means. And now, because of broadband, there are so many choices and actually, as you mentioned, choices for consumers that really gives operators a bit more leverage when it comes to negotiating those legacy video packages. But we are moving towards more of an over-the-top world, and let's talk about a company that is major in over-the-top, and that's Netflix. Back in 2006, Netflix had 5.7 million subscribers. Today it has 137 million. Do you share a common assessment that Netflix has too big of a head start in over-the-top, even for those big new entrants that want to come in and compete like Disney?
Well, yes and no. I think if you step back, here's what I think makes this so interesting, right, is the value chain of media creation, starting with studios on through the aggregation function that used to be creating a schedule into what we now think of as a cable network or a broadcast network, into then those are aggregated together into to the media conglomerates, and then those are aggregated together into the package of video that you buy. That whole value chain has existed largely as an industry to syndicate the risk of studios, same as it is in the movie business, where the risky part of that proposition is studios, because you can have good years and bad years of creating good content or bad content. And then you have this very stable distribution business at the other end. And so the risk in that system was syndicated by making sure that all the studios would do output deals with all the different distributors, with intermediaries in between, so that the risk was spread across the whole system. And the idea that if a studio had a bad year, they could weather the storm because of the syndication of risk. Well, when Netflix saw the writing on the wall, that first with Stars and others started to pull back their content from Netflix, Reed Hastings, I think, clearly understood the only path forward for me is to start producing my own content. Mm-hmm. And he struck gold right away with House of Cards and Orange is the New Black in that first season of big shows, and some would argue it was brilliant luck. But he has now transitioned to what is essentially a closed media system. A studio produces, or you're on the path for a studio to produce everything that it sells, and for a distributor to sell only what it produces. If you're going to win in that game, what you've really done is you've massively reconcentrated the risk that used to be syndicated across the whole industry into one company. And the only way you can mitigate that risk is by getting enormously large. so that the probability that you're just producing so much content in a year that the probability that all of it is lousy in a given year is reasonably low. That's a hard game to win at. And by the way, I'm still not sure that it's a game that even Netflix can win. You know, Ted Sarandos at Netflix has said, we're going to have to not only produce hit shows every year, we're going to have to produce at least one hit show every month in order to sustain the business model. And by the way, I don't even think that's enough, because in this day and age, a hit show is what, 5% of your customers might be engaged in any one hit show. That might mean that I need a new hit show for every 5% cohort that I have. So I may need 20 hit shows every month. And so I've got an enormous scale problem that Netflix still may not be nearly big enough to support this being anything other than just an okay business. Disney strikes me as having the wherewithal and the stomach for making sure that they're a real player. And so I think you'll at least have two. But beyond that, I'm not sure I see anybody else. Amazon certainly could be if they chose to be, but I'm not sure they are going to choose to be. They can't seem to decide what they want to do in media. But you know, I look at all the others, and there are lots of people that are talking about direct-to-consumer plays like HBO and the new AT&T and Comcast and others, but I'm not sure that any of them have the stomach for saying, in order to make this work, I've just got to get unbelievably big, and that's going to take huge investment ahead of profit. In a somewhat speculative and uncertain outcome of about whether it actually works or not. I don't know that how many of those we're going to see. I used to think there's going to be a world where we're going to see three or four or five of them, but I'm not sure I can identify anybody that has the stomach for saying we really want to try.
A related question, but do you see Hulu in that mix?
No. Remember, Hulu, for all intents and purposes, is now Disney. I sort of scratched my head over, I don't know what Disney or what Hulu is going to become. You know, Hulu is now two of the founding partners, Fox and Disney, are now one. And so now it's a collection of now just three companies, Disney and Comcast and Time Warner. And Time Warner has said they're going to go direct to consumer. With Warner Brothers under AT&T, and I don't know whether Comcast will continue to provide NBC programming to Hulu, and I'm not even sure it's all that interesting even if they do. And so you can easily imagine a future where Hulu is just another brand name for Disney's direct-to-consumer model, and I've got to believe Disney's brand name is better than Hulu's, so I don't know. I don't mean to write Disney's strategy for them, because I have no idea what they're going to do. But it's not entirely clear to me what role Hulu has in this long term.
Well, you mentioned the choices that are now available through over-the-top to consumers, provided by our members via their broadband pipes. But is there a threat to a broadband provider when you look at so much over-the-top that's available? Particularly if you think that over-the-top at some point is going to overtake the traditional model and perhaps extinguish it. What are the threats there to broadband providers because of this increasing amount of over-the-top?
Well, so I guess the first thing I would say is there is an old saw in this industry that broadband churn is lower among customers who take video than among customers who don't. And that churn argument is still one of the big arguments I always hear for why you've got to hang on to video, because it helps lower broadband churn. I'm actually pretty skeptical of that. Now, look, I know that it is very clear empirically that the churn rate of broadband among people who take video is only about half of the churn rate of broadband among people who don't take video. But that is not the same as saying that having video bundled to broadband is causality. If you just simplistically said, well, look, the average person who takes broadband only and gets their video via OTT is likely to be much younger, a millennial instead of a baby boomer. And by virtue of being much younger, is much more likely to live in an apartment building instead of a house, is much more likely to not have children than have children, to be unmarried rather than married. All of that stuff would tell me, if I just normalize for the demographics of who tends to be a broadband-only customer versus who tends to be a bundled customer, I'd probably find that that explains all, or maybe even more than all, of the churn benefit associated with bundling video, which is to say, bundling video and broadband together may not actually have any benefit whatsoever to broadband churn rates after you normalize for demographics. And my suspicion is that when that work is done properly, that's actually what it shows. So in that sense, I don't think there is a particularly big risk. Oddly enough, if there is a real risk, it tends to be a policy and regulatory risk. That is, that the more that the business starts to resemble a pure connectivity business, the easier it is for regulators to monkey around with it and start to think that it should be regulated in some way.
Which opens up a whole new avenue of thought when we think of our political environment and the 2020 election and what could happen from there, as we have seen in the past before a very regulatory FCC, as well as now a very deregulatory FCC. So certainly something to think about as we think of our members as being, you know, more direct providers of broadband and maybe that only. But while we're on the topic of broadband itself, you've indicated in some of your writing and research that broadband is definitely inching towards saturation. How do you see that maybe in the bigger picture? And does serving the enterprise sector help to keep that cable broadband story growing?
Well, yeah. So first on the topic of saturation, wired broadband is sitting right around 80% penetration in the United States today, 80% of occupied households. As you probably know better than anybody, the FCC has always struggled with measuring how much of the country doesn't actually have access to broadband. There's some interesting stuff that just came out from Microsoft a couple of weeks ago, that tries to get at that issue through a different way. The FCC, remember, has always had these issues of if there is at least one broadband connection of a certain speed in a zip code, then one assumes that the whole zip code, and then it was the census block and what have you, but they were still just kind of rough approximations, and I think everybody understood they weren't particularly accurate. If you said there's something like 10% of the country that still doesn't have access to wired broadband at broadband speeds, then we're effectively 8/9 of penetrated. That is, the addressable market's only 90% of the country, and we're 80% there. And so there isn't all that much runway left for incremental penetration. And by the way, and it wouldn't be a surprise to anybody, that at least the data that we've seen, it's a bit outdated now, but data from Pew and others would suggest that the households that don't yet have broadband tend to be very, very low income. They tend to be educationally disadvantaged. They tend to be elderly. And in most cases, they tend to be households that don't own a device by which to access the internet. And so it's hard to sell broadband to somebody that doesn't have a device that can use it. And so the idea that we're going to continue to push penetration at a rapid pace is just not realistic. Now, that doesn't mean that we won't see penetration continue to rise until eventually it gets awfully close to 100%. I think that's what will happen, but it's going to be through the slow attrition of those homes and replacement of those homes with younger occupants and what have you. So the saturation issue is a real issue. Now, broadband from cable operators continues to take share, and I think it will continue to take share from telco options that are technologically inferior. You know, it used to be that you would have a very, very strong case against legacy DSL because the speed differences were so large, and then that war was mostly won. And then it was, well, now we've got a pretty good case against IP DSLAM DSL because the speeds that those products can offer in the 10 to 20 megabits per second range are no longer really all that competitive. Then it was against fiber to the neighborhood solutions in the 25 to even 50 megabits per second range, and even those products became inadequate. And so the cable industry has continued to take share against the telcos in cohort after cohort after cohort, and I don't think there's any reason to think that that won't continue. And then, as you say, there is also this still largely untapped market of the commercial services market, where in a very analogous way, the industry started addressing small businesses, and then it started addressing medium businesses, and now the industry is just starting to get meaningfully focused on the enterprise market. And this goes way back to my BCG days, but there's something like 90% of the companies in the commercial market count as small business, another 9% count as medium business, and 1% count as enterprise. But the revenue split is something like 30% small business, 35% for each of medium and large. And so the industry still is relatively early days in tapping into the real revenue pool of commercial services, even though they've got a pretty high market share now. That is, the cable industry has a pretty high market share in sheer number of locations.
Interesting in your answer, the first part of your answer regarding the telecom companies and broadband's availability to compete very effectively against that. You know, the big telecom companies may not agree with you when they are putting a lot of effort and money behind 5G wireless networks that they think will pose a serious challenge to cable broadband ISP. What's your take on that?
That I guess the jury is still out. You know, that it's hard to pin down exactly what 5G really is, right? To some people, I think there's three definitions of 5G out there. There is 5G as a set of technology protocols, and that's what it actually is. But there's also 5G as a set of spectrum bands, most of, you know, what we have come to call the millimeter wave spectrum bands. And then there's 5G as a set of use cases for things like IoT and driverless cars and that sort of stuff. It emphatically is not that. So the real definition of 5G, I suppose, you know, if you think about 5G, let me say it slightly differently. My reservations about 5G have nothing to do with the technology behind 5G. My reservations about 5G have to do with the spectrum bands that they're using for 5G. Count me as somewhat skeptical that 5G millimeter wave-based fixed wireless broadband will be economically meaningfully advantaged versus building fiber to the home. And interestingly, Verizon, for example, which is clearly the company that is the most vocal about the 5G opportunity, has said there's about a 30% addressable market, about 30% of the country is sort of the addressable market for the 5G technology, as the way they're thinking about fixed wireless broadband. Well, they haven't said it's precisely based on density, but it's essentially based on density, right? It's where small radii cell sites have enough servable market in their radius or in their coverage area to make it economically viable to serve that market. Well, the densest 30% of the country happens to also be the exact 30% of the country that already has been and continues to be targeted by fiber to the home. And by the way, there are other technologies out there for 5G, like Starry is an example of a company that we followed closely that has gotten a lot of publicity. Starry also thinks there's about a 30% available market for their technology, which is a macro cell-based technology, same 30% of the country. So I think what you're seeing is kind of a pattern that most old hands in telecom have seen for 25 years, which is new technologies constantly being aimed at the same 30% of the market. And count me as somewhat skeptical that at the end of the day, yet another competitor serving the same 30% of the market is really going to change the competitive dynamics of the industry all that much.
Let me ask you a general question and get your take on it. 2 years ago, Silicon Valley, big tech, the edge providers, Google, Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Twitter, Netflix could do no wrong. 2 years later, I don't think it seems as if they can do anything right. Given all of the many disclosures about use of data by big tech companies, by their involvement in what might be, you know, election fraud or at least manipulation, et cetera, privacy concerns, what do you see here as we enter a new Congress led by the Democrats in the House in 2019 and going forward about maybe perhaps what kind of actions Washington might take to regulate big tech and what kind of impact that might have not only on privacy issues but net neutrality issues going forward?
Well, so I guess there's really three buckets, right? There's antitrust, there's privacy, there's and then there's net neutrality, which is at least for our purposes uniquely interesting. With respect to antitrust, my guess is it's still a bridge too far. To think that either Congress or the DOJ or the Federal Trade Commission or the courts has the stomach to try to break up any of the large tech companies. So that will be a topic that certainly gets conversation, but probably doesn't get a lot of traction is my guess. But in the, there is certainly a sense of urgency about doing something, and the doing something will very likely start with privacy. And so I would be, you know, there aren't many things that you can imagine bipartisanship over, but there is real bipartisanship now over the privacy issue. And as long as it doesn't get dragged into the morass of whether or not there is a conservative or liberal bias in what the kind of news that is presented by different online outlets, which is something that has, for obvious reasons, becomes highly partisan and from my view, somewhat silly. As long as it doesn't go down that rat hole and it stays focused on privacy, I think there is a very real chance that we'll see some movement on privacy, and it's probably not going to be particularly welcome. You've seen it, and remember, these are very global companies, so they're already facing that in Europe, and they have to eventually conform globally to these kinds of standards. But the really interesting thing to me is net neutrality, because I've spent so many years on that topic, as have you, Matt. It's been a sort of breathtaking change in the conversation this last year or so. Precisely because of the privacy violations that have just happened over and over and over again coming from big tech. Because there was very much a view 4 years ago under the Wheeler administration, say, that the cable and telephone companies were the bad guys and Google and Netflix and Facebook were the good guys. And net neutrality was essentially a moral play about you and I may have always viewed it as a commercial dispute about whether there was or wasn't a price for transport. But in the eyes of the general public, it was good versus evil. It was good companies versus bad companies. Well, 4 years later, there are no good companies left in this play. There's no white hats left in the room. Certainly Google, Facebook, and Netflix are no longer wearing white hats in this. And you could sort of feel the energy get sucked out of the political debate as this kind of morality play lost all of its potency. The politicians just don't care anymore. There's no appetite to try to defend the position of Google's or Facebook's in this debate anymore. My sense is all of the energy around net neutrality has just vaporized in the last 18 months.
It's been interesting, though, too, when you look at the facts over the past year, since the time when Chairman Pyatt, the FCC, repealed the previous net neutrality order, you know, how much greater investment there has been in broadband deployment. We see statistics from Cable Labs that say 63% of U.S. housing units today have gigabit speed broadband access, when only 23 months ago that stood at 4%. It does raise the issue of what, you know, what impact Washington has, despite the fact that, you know, at a time when perhaps it may look to be a bit more regulatory on some of these issues, you know, by the same token, they also keep saying we need to deploy more. So it is certainly good to see more deployment, but Washington certainly can have an impact on it.
Yeah, I suppose that's right. It certainly is, you know, just the statistic that you cited. You and I traded some emails about this before. It really is just breathtaking to see the expansion in gigabit broadband availability, and cable has a fantastic story to tell there, and so you know, it's something that the industry should be celebrating. Obviously, in Washington, it has some potency as something to celebrate, but it should be celebrated by consumers too, because it really is a dramatic part of the infrastructure story of the United States to see just how much of the country now has access to gigabit per second broadband. You know, you see all these old silly tropes year after year about we're lagging behind Latvia or whatever nonsense you'd hear a couple of years ago, and those arguments have now happily fallen away. And as I say, cable has a really good story to tell.
Craig, I have two more questions for you. One on substance, and then I'll give you some time to think, to get your crystal ball out. But when we talk about vertical integration, other media consolidation, we see now Nexstar, Tribune, AT&T, Time Warner, which is still going through the courts. Certainly ACA has raised a number of issues about continuing review of Comcast, NBC Universal, T-Mobile, Sprint. Is this a trend that's going to continue in your view, and do you see any changes or any influence by Washington on that process going forward?
Well, with or without Washington, my suspicion is that trend is going to lose steam fast, or probably already has. There's a number of reasons for that. One is, you know, what's happening in the capital markets suggests that the markets are starting to get more nervous about a recession, whether that comes in 2019 or more likely 2020 or 2021 or whenever it comes. There is an appropriate anxiety about going into that recession whenever it comes with too much debt on your balance sheet. And so I think that will provide a bit of a damper on M&A. You've still got big questions, as you mentioned, with regulatory, about what the DOJ and the Federal Trade Commission will and won't allow. I think right now the uncertainty about what exactly are the rules of the road with respect to vertical and horizontal integration are muddier than they've ever been, at least in my career. And then the third thing, and what ultimately is by far the most important of the three, is it's not clear that any of these deals actually make any sense. You know, I think it's a year and a half ago, Verizon was under all kinds of pressure to say, look, AT&T has mapped out a strategy and they're preparing for the future, and Verizon, you're just sitting on your hands and you've got to go out and do something big to keep pace with AT&T. Well, now the narrative 18 months later is, there but for the grace of God go I. And Verizon is being patted on the back for having avoided making any big misguided transactions. And I think there is a very real sense that people want to wait and see whether any of these deals actually work before anybody wants to go out and replicate them. Now, it's a little bit different in the horizontal types of transactions in broadcasting, for example, which are at least strategically not very risky. There's regulatory questions around them, but the model of whether they work or not isn't really all that in question. But for these big transactions like the vertical deals, I don't know that there's anybody that wants to go down that path right now because it's just not clear it's a good idea.
All right, Craig, crystal ball time. 20 years ago, AOL was the internet and BlackBerry was the indispensable mobile device. We both know where they are today, but how about your thoughts concerning who among tech giants today might be the AOL or BlackBerry of 2038, or if you want to go that route to predict maybe the demise of some of the companies that we take for granted today, maybe what you see as future developments to come over the next 20 years?
Well, look, I think infrastructure is likely to be a constant. There will be competitors to infrastructure, but it's hard to imagine a world where we're not going to need infrastructure anymore. And so the infrastructure piece of it will be the stable piece. I do wonder whether, and it's not terribly clever or novel of me to ask, but I do wonder whether the scale of Google and Amazon has become so large that they are almost impregnable, and that it's just the capital required to create these marketplace businesses is so astronomically large now that the moat is getting really, really big. And that's why the conversation in Washington about antitrust is becoming so urgent. We're getting to a position where the railroads wouldn't have failed on their own. They had to be broken up back in the late 1800s. I do wonder whether that conversation will be the defining conversation of tech. Is that look, there are some that where Snapchats and things where there's real debate, or even Netflix, I guess, where there's real debate about the permanence of that business. But something like Google or Amazon, it's much harder to see in those kinds of winner-take-all network-based businesses. Once you get to such a dominant position of aggregation, how it is that someone can break that lock?
Well, Craig Moffett, we have gone much longer than expected. We could go on for hours. It has been such a pleasure to have you with us here on ACA's Cable Talk. You've been such a good friend and partner with our members, speaking at our summit, our independent show, and other events. Thanks very much for your time here today on Cable Talk.
My pleasure, and I wish you and your family, and I wish all of the listeners a very, very happy holidays.
And to you too, sir. That's another edition for ACA's Cable Talk. Matt Polka here. We will look to see you soon on the next edition of Cable Talk. See you later, everybody.